Today is January 9, 2013. This is Desiree Hargis on behalf of the H.J. Letcher Stark Center for Physical Culture and Sports. As part of the 1968 U.S. Olympic Team Oral History Project, I am interviewing 1968 Olympic gold medalist decathlon champion Bill Toomey over the phone about his experiences in the 1968 Olympic Games in Mexico City. Bill, can you begin with when and where you were born and where you grew up?
Yeah, I was born, and my mother was a nurse at one of the first teaching medical hospitals in Philadelphia, Jefferson Hospital. My older brother and I were born in Philadelphia, and I have a younger brother who was born in New York. And we grew up in Long Island, Forest Hills, and then Port Washington, and then finally high school at New Canaan High School, and I graduated very young, so I took an extra year at Worcester Academy, which was a very, very worthwhile, you know, because I actually got better at all the sports. That 1 year of maturity was really a bonus, because it really led to a scholarship at University of Colorado. I had a friend there. I wrote him and told him what I had accomplished in the New England Championships. And I think I improved almost 3 feet in the long jump in that 1 year. And I was coached in basketball by Dee Rowe, who was the University of Connecticut basketball coach. We won the New England Championships, but the workouts he gave us really prepared me to be a top long jumper, at least in New England. I later found out that they were jumping a little bit further in California, but, you know, you have to put in perspective the coaching, the facilities, the fact that there was still snow on the ground when we started, and we didn't have that many meets. But, and you later learn that a longer run will give you a better jump. And but a lot of these technical pieces of information, at least in track and field, were obscure to a lot of us. I mean, this was 1956 and 57. I graduated from Worcester, and my folks moved to California. And one of the things that I found to be really exciting about the move was they had track meets during the summer at Stanford University every Saturday for 25 cents. And there were guys from the Pan Am Games, the Olympic Games, and just young kids, and anybody could enter. And ultimately that was going to be leading me to try a lot of events. And while I'm at the University of Colorado, I'd come home for those meets. That gave me a chance to do some of the events that I couldn't do in the college program because I didn't have experience. But little by little, incrementally, I started, you know, getting into more events that I did in college, and things like the hurdles and the pole vault were really, I was almost a disgrace when I started. Hmm. But the fact was that they had an event called the Pentathlon, and nobody really got into it. But I drove to Kansas City and won my first All-American patch and got first place in the Pentathlon and set an American record. And then the next 3 years, something like that, won that event. And then I made the big leap to the decathlon, and my first decathlon was pretty much of a bust. I didn't score but about 5,000 points. And of course that didn't, you know, scare any East Germans at the time. And, but I really didn't come out of it feeling that well. And it was just really an incredibly difficult event, especially when you haven't prepared for it. I was in shape, but, you know, you're never in shape, you know, for something like a decathlon, 2 days of competition and stiffness and events you haven't really tried much. And then I think it was 1962, they had another decathlon at an all-comer meet, and I wrote down 6,000 points and put it in my sock drawer, paid my, it was 50 cents because it was 2 days, went over, and I determined that if I could score 6,000 points that I would dedicate myself to the decathlon. Mm-hmm. Well, I did. I scored 6,300 points and was on my way, but I had no clue. There was no decathlon coaches. And to make a long story short, one of my teammates from Colorado was from Canada, and he came down to train with me and live with me in Burlingame. Then I was a graduate student at Stanford, and he kind of enlightened me to how to train for the decathlon, at least to the best of his ability. And that's where the big change came. And then I entered my first AAU decathlon. I did not want to go to the Nationals and not have a chance for a medal. And I ended up fifth, and I was very proud of myself. I think it was about, I don't know how many points, it was just something over 6,000 points. And in 64, I made the Olympic trials, but I didn't make the team, and I missed it by one spot. But I had gotten up to well over 7,000 points, I think 75 or 7,600 points, and it I felt that this gave me enough impetus. And I went to the Olympics in Tokyo as a spectator, and I realized that, you know, I didn't know what it was that I was training for, something you'd heard of, something you'd see in Sports Illustrated. Track didn't have a lot of television coverage in those days. But when you go to the Olympics and you sit in the stands and you actually see it, you then can get the energy back to look at four more years of training. And so when I came back home, I set myself in L.A. and trained at UCLA. And but while I was in Tokyo, the Germans had stolen the decathlon title from the U.S. Willy Holdorf was a gold medalist. Hans-Joachim Walde, who I would later get to know, and Horst Beyer got third and sixth. So the Germans got two out of the three medals. The second place was an Estonian. His name is Rein Aun. I would be competing against him in the future. So I guess my Olympic beginning was as a spectator, but that's where I gained the motivation to, you know, give it my best. And in my training in the fall of 64, got me prepared for an indoor meet in San Francisco where I beat all the Olympians in all the races that I won. And everybody seemed to be shocked that they never really knew who I was, but I beat Paul Drayton, the silver medalist in the 200, and Jack Yearman, a gold medalist, and Mike Larrabee, a gold medalist, both guys in the 400. That was kind of how I got into it.
Yeah, that was a great summary of your experience leading up to the games. Backing up just a little bit, when you were very small and you first started, you know, pursuing athletics, what initially drove you to do that? Were any of your family members pushing you to do that? Did you have family that were competing in or participating in athletics?
I went to a Catholic grammar school in Long Island, and Forest Hills, where they used to have the major tennis tournaments. And I don't think I ever saw a tennis tournament, but they joined a club for us, and that club had swimming and had basketball. And I can remember the first day of basketball, some kid grabbed the ball, ran all the way down the end without dribbling, and threw the ball over the back of the backboard. And I thought, well, I guess we're all starting from scratch. But we had a coach, and this coach was a tremendous asset. And I'm finishing a book, and I really want to dedicate it to those unsung heroes that coach not college kids or Olympic athletes, but those youngsters who don't really understand discipline and the importance of discipline and consistency. And this coach, his name is Lou House, and he was a strict disciplinarian. He drove us, but I loved it. And I never missed a practice. And except one day I got sick. I had a temperature of about 102 or something. And I can remember him saying, there's no excuse to miss a practice. So I jumped out the back window of our house and ran over to the club, which was a pretty fair distance, but, you know, not that far. Put my stuff on, and I was kind of really ashen-faced. And later my mother kind of came in, and she figured out what happened. And she said, you know, to the coach, he's sick, he shouldn't be here. And he said, oh my God, he said, well, take him home. And he said, perhaps I'm responsible, but he's a good boy, and let him know that this is fine. And so I went home and stayed in bed for another week or two, whatever it was. But I mean, I remember that's kind of one of those moments that defines where you put your energy and how devoted you can be to a sport. But basketball was my love. But when you think about it, basketball is a great sport to train for the jumps.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's basically, you know, driving into layups and things like that. And I saw a guy when I was a freshman, and he took off well away from the basket and sort of floated in the air. And it mesmerized me. And so I tried from then on to emulate that. And so I continually jumped, and I jumped. We had to take chairs down at the Catholic Church after Mass to play basketball. So I would be jumping over rows of chairs and see how many rows I could jump over until I got to the point where I could have had a serious injury. And I'd jump over fences, anything that would be sort of in my way that I thought, you know, I'd stare it down and just scissor over. And then in high school, as a sophomore, we moved to Connecticut, and the coach brought in these ancient standards and a couple wrestling mats and had the class all try the high jump. I think they started at 4 feet or less. And, of course, I had been practicing my fence jumping and my chair jumping, and I was the only kid that could make 5 feet. So in my high school, the football coach was our basketball coach, and he was our track coach. And I had been in baseball, and I had started out in baseball because I really had a lot of background. I'd never been in track. But he said, you're the best jumper in high school. And I said, really? He said, there's a state meet in a week or two at Yale. I'd like to enter you. Would you be? Oh, yeah, I'd love to jump. So I went there and jumped, scissored 5'8" as a sophomore in my first meet and won the state meet in small schools. So that's kind of my first track meet.
Mm-hmm.
And we even had our cheerleaders there. It was kind of cool.
Oh, wow.
But it had a wooden takeoff, so it wasn't just dirt. It was a good takeoff area. But, you know, we didn't have the short shoes. We didn't have – but I had a background in jumping that was a little bit unusual for the average kid.
Mm-hmm.
I had virtually no coaching, and but we had – you know, all the kids supporting us, and then I tried the long jump, and I won the long jump, and I was doing it in flats. I didn't know you could use. I didn't have a pair of spikes. I think I jumped 19 feet.
Wow!
And then the next year I jumped 20 feet 3 inches, and then just under 21 feet. And then when I went to Worcester, as I told you, I played basketball under one of the probably top national coaches who later became a coach of Connecticut and was in the Final Four in the NCAA. But he drilled us. And, of course, I was in a prep school with no girls. had a lot of energy, and all you could do there was study, eat, and run. So we won the New England championships in basketball. So we had some top players. I was lucky to make first ring, but had some great games and even won one game with the last shot. And but when I went out to the track, my first meet, I jumped 22 feet, like 6 inches. And nobody was more bewildered, but I didn't even, I only took a run as long as the length of the runway. And it really wasn't very long. And then finally, at the end of the season in the New England's, I was the only athlete that made 23 feet. And, you know, I probably, thinking back, if I would have known what I was doing, if I would have had any kind of coaching, probably could have done 24 feet. Mm. Because even in college, with that length of a run, it would have been tough to make 23 feet. It was just a very short run.
Mm-hmm.
But once again, you don't know. And then my brother entered me in the 400. He lied and said that I had done 53. Well, I'd never broke 56. And so in those days, they didn't have stagger. They lined us up straight across, and I was the slowest time entered, and I was in lane 8, so I was going to be running longer because there was no staggers. And he said, don't let these guys get ahead of you. Run to the corner where the curve starts and try and get ahead of as many guys as you can. Well, I'd never run the 400 that way. We always jogged the first part and then sprinted the last part. You know, so we'd get 56, 57. Mm-hmm. No, but we didn't know. It, you know, this is a long time ago, and, you know, track was a half a letter. It wasn't even a full letter.
Mm-hmm.
And so I followed this guy around the track and almost beat him in 51 seconds. And I couldn't get off the ground for about 20 minutes. But I had this really challenging kind of energy. And I, in a way, found it to be a marvelous challenge. And I was attracted to the 400 because of the fact that it demanded so much. And I had just that little bit of success, second in New England's. I won the high jump and the long jump. And my brother got first in the 800, and we almost won the New England championships, the two of us, prep schools. I was, you know, I then moved to California, and I had a scholarship to Holy Cross, and it wasn't a big scholarship, but when I moved to California, I asked the kid down the street what it was like here in the winter. And he said, look up at the sky. He said, it's just like this. And I said, I don't think I'm going back to that wire mill town, Worcester. Worcester Academy is where I went, but I owe them a lot because that's where I got my basic training, so to speak.
Right.
But I was going to go to Stanford or Cal, but I needed to make up some courses, so I went to a junior college. And I played basketball for the junior college, made the team. But just before the first game, I wrote a letter to an old teammate at Colorado, and he went in and told the coach about me. And the coach wrote me a letter and invited me to fly there. I'd never been in an airplane, and I was a freshman in college. Well, the basketball coach wasn't too happy because I was one of the better guys he had. But if I played one game, I would have lost a whole year of eligibility.
Mm-hmm.
So when I went to Colorado, it was the most beautiful place I'd ever seen. And it was like a dream camp. It was like a movie set. And I said, where do I sign? And so my meeting with the coach at the end, just before I went home, was to determine, you know, I mean, I was ready to shake his hand and say, I'll be back. You know, my folks have enough money, et cetera. He said, well, I can give you your books. And I was about to say, okay, I agree. And then he said, I can give you tuition. And I'm going, wow, tuition. And so I gagged myself. And then he said, room and board and $25 a month. So I had a full ride.
Wonderful.
And of course, where I was playing basketball at Menlo, I was paying my own way, so I didn't feel very guilty.
Mm-hmm.
So I drove through the snow in the winter and from California to Colorado in January and matriculated into the University of Colorado and had the best years of my life.
Oh, that's wonderful. Bill, that brother you mentioned earlier, was he an older brother or a younger brother, the one that you competed?
Yeah, he was going to go to Colorado College. He made the mistake of sitting with us and hanging out for a couple of days at CU. And he went to Colorado College, made a U-turn back to CU and said, I'm going back to Menlo, but I'm going to enroll here next year. So he joined me and we were together at the university. And he played, he was on the track team, you know, as he was with me in high school. And then my youngest brother, years later, came and was an all Big Eight pitcher and drafted by the Dodgers. And then his arm kind of got damaged. You know, pitching is really kind of a dangerous thing when you have to be careful with how many throws you do and et cetera. But anyway, Colorado was my base of operations. And by the time I was getting ready to leave, I owned the place. I mean, I knew everybody, and I wasn't great, but I won the Big Eight one time, and I was most valuable in one of the indoor meets and broke a couple of field house records, but never a threat for the Olympics.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't know that.
Mm-hmm.
And so I got into Stanford Graduate School, home of the all-cover meets, and got my master's there. And so I was going to school and trying to prepare for the 64 games. I got injured just before the final trials and ended up fourth. And I was very despaired until my dad gave me a ticket and flew me to Tokyo. And it woke me up and to the reality of what I had missed. And so I did something very unusual. Since the Germans had done so well, I sought out the German coach. I don't know what got into me. And I found him, and one of the German athletes translated. And I said, could I come to Germany next year and train with you and the team? And he said, yes. And it was, I don't know what kind of karma it was, but I won the Nationals, made the U.S. team that went to Russia, 100,000 Russians in the stands, many of whom probably had to be there. My parents were there, and I got second. But I really, my shot and discus, my first discus throw, so I was so nervous. I don't think it was 80 feet in the ground, another 20 feet. But I ended up at least in second place, and then we went on to Germany. I got second place against Germany. And then somebody came and said, does anybody want to go to the World Student Games? And it had traditionally been for communist countries. And so this is the first time the U.S. had ever been part of it. So here I am, you know, I'm still a novice. And John Pinnell, the world record holder in the vault, and I were roommates. And we were, you know, tied together at the hip. He was one of my great friends. And we had about eight other guys. And the basketball team had like Bill Bradley and guys like that. But the track team, we only had eight, but I think we won like seven gold medals. Anyway, it was raining and I didn't know what chance I had or not, but I ended up winning the World Student Games. They gave me this huge medal. And of course, I made the AP and the guy said, I used to wear glasses and the guy said, he looks more like a pharmacist than a decathlete. And but when you win something like that on a world basis, it gives you really a lot of impetus. But I went to Germany and trained and really learned a lot. There's nuance. Every culture does things differently. So I adapted certain things in the German culture and the German training. And then I got sick. I was visiting a young lady in Stockholm. And I, Christmas Eve, I got a temperature that was very high, and they had to take me to the hospital. There was no beds available. They put me on a gurney. The first thing they said is I had tuberculosis.
Oh, my goodness.
And pretty soon, I mean, I had to get back to Germany. I was sicker than a dog. Just I lost probably 15 pounds. And they put me in the sport. I went to the Sporthochschule, which is in Cologne. I belonged to a club, and it was right next to the club. And the doctors immediately put me in the hospital, the Krankenhaus. And the first night, a guy died in the next bed, and I didn't know. Everybody was speaking German so rapidly, and four or five doctors would surround me, and then they put me in a room, and I read the sign, Anschlussverboten, entry forbidden. So obviously I was a serious case of something. So I had hepatitis, they said, and it could be infectious. So they had to keep me away from everybody. I was so bored, I escaped just to buy some magazines because there was nothing in the room. They absolutely went nuts. And so I went back in. They finally decided that I wasn't infectious. And I said, look, I want to go home. I said, I can't stay in this hospital. I said, I'm getting worse. And so I flew home, and by then I was about 20 pounds down and kind of yellow pallor. And so from December 24th till April 1st, I was in bed. And, but there was something about just lying in bed thinking about and reading about guys like Russ Hodge, who was junior college, winning every event, breaking all kinds of records. And, you know, he was a friend of mine and a guy that I was going to compete against. And so I got out April 1st. I drove to L.A. and I decided this is too crazy, too much traffic, too many tickets. So I went to Santa Barbara, and a friend of mine was the assistant coach. And he said, why don't you stay here? I'll help you. My first workout was one lap walking on April 2nd, and I used to take an hour nap before and an hour nap afterwards. And slowly but surely, I started adding things. And then the Nationals were July 3rd, 4th, and I was defending champion, so I got my way paid. But from April 1st to July 3rd and 4th, that was a period I had to prepare. Went to Pierce College, did an all-comer meet, ran a couple of events, did okay. But just before that, they called me and asked me if I wanted to be in a relay, and I said yes without even thinking. Drove to the Coliseum, was scared to death because I didn't know whether I could even finish it. But I did all right, and I didn't want to know my time. And in relays, you don't have to get them. So then we went to Salina, Kansas for the Nationals, and it was over 100 degrees. And, you know, when you've been sick and had mononucleosis, which led to the hepatitis.
Oh.
The first day was ahead of the world record.
That's amazing.
Personal best, 10-3 in the 100 meters, 25-6 in the long jump. 45-10 or 9 in the shot put, 6-4-5 in the high jump, and 47-something in the quarter. And then the next day, the hurdles, 14-something, and I beat Hodge in the discus, which was a shock to him, and ended up breaking the world record by a significant amount of points. And nobody could believe it, especially in L.A. They thought it was a hoax. Russ had also broken the world record. 2 weeks later, we broke the world record again. I did it first because I came in first, and then he beat me by like 19 points or something. So then he had the world record. But I still had the top score. And after that, I didn't have any injuries until 1967, an indoor meet. My knee collapsed, and I had a knee operation, and they didn't have arthroscopic, so I was in a cast for a month. And you could tell my time at the Nationals were way below normal, but I still was able to win. And these were dirt tracks in those days. These weren't carton. And so I made the Pan Am team and scored over 8,000 points. So I was really on the way back. And there's nothing like having physical control. And I mean, it's the most wonderful feeling in the world to be able to compete at a high level when you've been when you've been mediocre most of your life. You know, in college, I had some, every once in a while, I'd have a great day. And then I'd block, you know, my mind defeated me. Mm-hmm. But having been a world record holder, and they took it away from me because the weights and the hurdles were not correct. And I'm going, so I go to a national meet, and they don't even prepare it properly, and I lose a world record. So that kind of bothered me for the rest of my career, though I broke the world record, but it lasted like 19 seconds in the Coliseum, which is the slowest track in America. But good things were happening, and I think that in 1967, I went down to the pre-Olympic meet, and I pulled a muscle, and I was in the best shape of my life. Might have been the best thing that ever happened, because I probably would have been really a high score. I was somehow I had done things correctly to prepare myself for October. So I came back home, you know, to pull muscle. I was able to run a quarter mile. Get second in the open 400. I shouldn't have done it, but I took a shot, Novocaine, and I wanted to compete. But probably the best thing that ever happened was to not compete, because I was doing things better than I'd ever done. And so I said, I'm going to prepare myself next year exactly this way. So I didn't really try to get in shape for the trials. I wanted to aim for the Olympics. Mm-hmm. I was pretty confident that nobody else had broken 8,000 points. And so unless I get hurt, you know, I was in pretty good shape. And by then I was very consistent in everything. And so although I didn't like the idea that if I did get hurt with a minor injury that I'd have to finish, which might make it a major injury, even though I was the only guy over 8,000 points, and I kind of let everybody know it. I was a little upset. As they said, the first Olympic trials in Santa Barbara, which I did about 8,100 points, the first place would determine who was on the team. And they had 10 guys in each event go up to Tahoe to train. And they decided to take a vote whether they should accept the first trials. So 9 guys voted no, and 1 guy voted yes. What a bunch of idiots running track and field. Can you imagine that? And guys like Dave Patrick didn't make the team, although they said he did. And it was very, very unprofessional, let's put it that way. Uh-huh. However, you know, I had bigger fish to fry. I was preparing for the Germans, the Russians, and the Olympics. Mm-hmm. And so I became part of one of the greatest teams in history. And I had always planned in my head, way ahead. I planted seeds. I was very psychologically oriented. And once I got over the fear of competition and the fear of losing, I was more relaxed, and I learned how to become a winner. And it's not an easy transition, but I was able to make it, and I became probably one of the most consistent athletes ever on the decathlon. I only got defeated a couple times, and both times I was sick. And and I never dropped out except my last year. One time I ripped my cap open 2 weeks before the Nationals.
Oh, my goodness.
And it required like 43 stitches. And they sewed my cap up. And I said, you think I'll be ready 2 weeks? They said, God knows that we can't tell you. And I made it back in and made, and that was my first win. And then 1968, I really was very cautious about injuries. And I learned how to take time off before major competitions, which no coach had ever told me about. But I would take 7-8 days off. And I would come back with tremendous elasticity and muscle strength. And it was like a secret that I had. Other guys would be working out right up to the competition. You know, they were either insecure or God knows what word would describe it best. But, you know, your body, like anything else, treat it like a car, you know, change the oil. Give it a break. Don't drive it hard. And so I took off that time, and all of a sudden magic started happening during the Olympic Games. And I, the first day, I won 3 of the 5 events, and at 11 o'clock at night ran under 46 seconds in the 400.
Amazing.
Yeah. If I was in college and I ran that fast, I would have got a big head.
Yeah. Well, Bill, backing up just a little bit, how did your friends and family and, you know, people that knew you, how did they react to finding out that you made the Olympic team?
Well, my dad was at the trials, and he would come to most of the meets he could. He was an official. So he was on the field and got to see it firsthand, and my mom thought she was a jinx. But she came to the Pan Am Games, and then she came to the Olympics. And I almost scared her to death because I almost fouled out in the pole vault, which would have meant that I would have lost in all the points in one event. And you can't win in 9 events. But somehow I made that last try and was able to get my best vault of my life that day. But that last vault, after missing 2, somebody had stolen my poles and left them behind a locked door at the warm-up track. And they brought everybody's poles down. And when I looked, there was my poles were missing. And there was no one I could ask. Donbe, Estama, you know, forget it. Nobody knew. I ran to the warm-up track, which was 800 meters away from the stadium, uphill, and got this locked door and broke it open, and there were my poles lying there. I was sabotaged. I'll never know who did it. But obviously somebody segregated my poles and put them behind this door and locked it.
Whoa, that's scary.
TV people didn't even know this.
Really?
So I came down, and I was the first up because I was the worst vaulter. And I missed the first height, missed the second height. Third time I went down, stopped in the middle, came back, and I had 25 seconds left, or they would call it an attempt because, you know, there was a 2-minute time limitation. So I had to make some decisions that were akin to a gamble, and it basically worked. And at each vault, I got a little bit better.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of people knew me as a college athlete, and they said, God, if only I had kept going, because I was better than you were. and you think, yeah, sure. Mm-hmm. They don't know the price. They don't know the price you pay in workouts, and the fact that I had trouble finding people to work out because everybody wanted to play.
Mm.
And wanted to throw the shot or the javelin, but nobody wanted to seriously run like I did.
Mm-hmm. Well, Bill, tell me a little bit about the high altitude training and any preparation that you did for the high altitude of Mexico City.
Well, there's a combination of the physiological, obviously, because of the your hemoglobin is not meeting the after 2 minutes it kicks in the problem. So anything under 2 minutes is pretty much going to be the same. So the 800 meter, the 400 meter, the 200 meter, 100 meter are not affected. the field events, there's a certain amount of fatigue that happens. But, you know, if you're in shape, your body. So they had that training camp for 10 weeks, but I went to the University of Colorado, which was a mile high.
Mm-hmm.
So my hemoglobin kicked right back in. Once you have the capacity, it comes back fast. While everybody else was falling down after the 400 and 1500, I was kind of standing up wondering what was going on. So for me, it was a positive because I always ran best at altitude. I probably was the only guy there happy that it was in Mexico City. When I first went to Colorado, I ran at 400 meters like the second week I was there. I went back to the dorm and went to bed at 3 o'clock and woke up at 3 o'clock the next day.
Wow.
So, but I was there for 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was an altitude athlete, but even though I went to Stanford, you know, your hemoglobin homeostasis sets in, and you go back to normal hemoglobin. But when mine was measured at Colorado, and the doctor said, boy, you have a high hemoglobin. And I didn't know what he was talking about, but that's the ability to carry oxygen.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, like the Kenyans who won 11 medals. I mean, if it had been another country, they wouldn't have won maybe three.
Mm-hmm.
So I was kind of a Kenyan in disguise.
Yeah. Well, in the months leading up to the Olympic Games, were you ever part of any medical studies or anything like that where they did blood draws and things like that trying to determine what the effects of the high altitude might be on some of the athletes?
No. We had a guy called Dr. Brepp who just gave us breathing lessons, which I thought were good. Other than that, no. Nobody did any physio. We had a videotape thing. I watched myself vault for the first time and increased my vault by a foot, and then the camera broke. So nobody bothered to get it fixed or asked for another one.
Mm-hmm.
These are the Stone Ages.
Yeah. Well,
seriously. I mean, they, you know, it's funny. My college coach that gave me the scholarship was the Olympic coach.
Oh, really?
But I'm a self-coached guy, and I had friends like Ron Whitney, who was in the intermediates. And I would work out with certain guys that I knew were tough. And he and I were close friends, and we'd go off. And not one thing I learned is stay away from the crowds and people who are showing off. Doesn't mean a thing. So we'd go to a track. There was nobody there except us. And, you know, you have to get smart when you're counting the days, you know, 10 days down, 9 days, I stop everything. And because injuries happen, probably a lot of injuries happen within the 2 weeks before the games. Just so much energy and the tartan was new and, guys were getting, you know, injuries to their, their heels and their different parts of the foot,
mm-hmm.
because tartan was, you know, harder than running on cinders and things.
I see.
You know, it was concrete under polyurethane, but it was fast.
And 68 was the first time they used that type of track, correct?
Right. Mm-hmm. A lot of people don't realize that most of my competitions were held on. When I broke the world record in Salina, it was Grass, Texas, one of the oldest type tracks. It was asphalt. And the first time I was on tartan was like the Pan Am Games.
Wow. Well, switching gears a little bit, Bill, was there anyone on the Olympic team, on your the U.S. Olympic team in 68 with whom you were particularly close?
Ron Whitney was one guy. John Pinnell.
Mm-hmm.
Lee Evans. I was pretty good friends with just about everybody.
Yeah.
I mean, it, since there was only a few decathletes, I wasn't a challenge to anybody, you know, and so it's kind of friends with everybody.
Yeah, that must have been nice.
Yeah, and I used to get information from different guys about their event, and I learned a lot by asking questions.
Mm-hmm.
And various tips would give me, I call them my bag of tricks, and that was how I beat guys that were better than me. I went the extra distance to find out what spike length I should use, what shoes I should use, what, whenever it rained, I high jumped and nobody else did. They all went under the trees, but I realized that it had rained in most of the decathlons from 1964 to 1960 to, you see these rain-soaked pictures. And so I was up against a 7-1 high jumper on my end, and it was raining like crazy. And I did close to my best, and he only beat me by an inch and a half because of the rain. I mean, it was slippery. And I hung in there. And then at 11 o'clock at night, we started at 9 in the morning. I had to run the 400. And I don't know where the energy came from, but I went out like a bullet and won by 30 yards in my heat.
Oh, amazing. Well, switching gears a little bit again, in the months leading up to the 68 games, do you remember hearing anything about possible protests or boycotts by members of the U.S. team?
I pretty much stayed away from that. I talked quietly to guys like Charlie Green, and they were upset that guys who were not going to be Olympic athletes were trying to make their decision. And, they wanted them to give up this rare gift of being an Olympian.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't going to work because this was too much to ask. And so they're track guys, and this is something that they owned, and they're not going to be persuaded by, an activist to give up the rarest gift an athlete can have, which is to be an Olympic athlete.
Mm-hmm. Well, do you remember hearing anything about student protests and violence in Mexico City 10 days before
the
start of the games?
300 kids shot down and built in a square who were student protesters. We didn't think the Olympics were even going to happen. I mean, all this stuff was maniacal. I mean, killing all those people. And then we watched into the stadium, and there was guys with guns surrounding the stadium.
And how did you feel about that?
A little bit eerie, but I was focused enough to realize that nothing was... I didn't fear anything. I mean, this was too big of a... There was too many important people there. You know that behind every one of those guys were another 10 that were probably disguised as civilians.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't going to let the public down, the Mexico City. This is too important.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of their statement to the world.
So when you first heard about the violence, did you know at that time that it was 300 kids that had been shot or?
A friend of mine was a writer for Sports Illustrated, kind of related back to a lot of us what was going on.
Oh, wow.
And, there was so much energy towards the Olympics. It was so important to us and to everybody, to the TV people, to Americans were more Olympic oriented than they are now. The drugs, unfortunately, have been a really negative halo for the Olympics. It has created a diminished interest where there's a sea of stimuli in NFL, NBA, Major League Baseball, the traditional sports, and only lately they got into testing for drugs. And the guy that played for the Giants, the big home run hitter, I can't think of his name right now, that became a huge story. And they then had all these hearings and legal things going on and catching guys and fining guys. But the Olympics had been testing. Wayne, I got tested both evenings of my event.
Mm-hmm. And what was that like?
Well, it took a long time because I was dehydrated at that altitude. So they gave me water, and then I got diarrhea. And the day after I finished, I was sicker than a dog, and I was in bed for probably 5 days. One more day earlier, and I would have been a nobody.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of our athletes got sick just by, you know, whatever you get when you drink water or eat salad or anything where water is. I pretty much stayed away from water and was very careful about. But still, when you're doing a drug test and they're giving you water, you don't have much control.
Right. Gosh. Well, what were your impressions of Mexico City when you first arrived there? And what did you think of the accommodations and of the event venues?
Well, I was living in an unused, unfinished bathroom with a gas leak. So I fixed the gas leak, put a mattress on the floor. It was exactly 6 feet long and about 3.5 feet wide. So I had enough room for a box to put my cover over it. I pulled a single locker in, and I put the mattress on the floor. I had been living on a mattress on the floor at home for years because of my back, and it would serve me well. So, and I decided not to go to the stadium until it was time because I didn't want to create, I had watched TV the first day, and Jay Sylvester, the discus thrower, looked at me and said, "Boy, you look awful." And I realized that I had an adrenaline drain from watching what was going on the TV. So I didn't watch TV. I didn't go to the stadium. I concentrated on what was at hand, and that was competition. And so I just read books, and Howard Cosell came by one day, and I got to know him, and he was interested in where Wade Bell was, and Wade was in the hospital. So I helped him, and we have become really great friends since then. He's passed away now, but he really took me to a lot of places in New York whenever I visited, and I went to his house for Christmas and stuff like that. He's a great guy. A lot of doors open up.
Yeah, I'm sure. What are your memories of the opening ceremony?
I got an outside position, which guys tried to fight for, and I said, "I'm not moving." And I was able to find my parents and see them.
Oh, that's
funny. They saw me. And I had been in the opening ceremonies at the Pan Am game, and it rained. And opening ceremonies was special. And a lot of athletes who were competing the next day didn't go. And it's regretful, you know, that they miss it because it's a very important part of what the Olympics were all about.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was, for me, it was my only event till I competed, which was more than a week or 10 days after that, October 18th and 19th.
Oh, wow. Were you able to go to any other events?
No, I didn't want to go to any events.
Hmm. And was that just to save your...
Oh, I mean, I was there the last day because I got my medal.
Right.
Because it was too late at night. And then I was getting interviewed and Cosell pulled me out and said, "His country needs to hear from him." And so I didn't even get my interviews from all these other countries. That's right, because I got on American TV and that's where I needed to be. And I was on the track when Ryan was running and he interviewed me on what was happening and I gave him my fix on it. And so, you know, by then we were becoming fast friends and he really was kind of like a godfather.
Mm-hmm. That's so wonderful that you got to know him that way. So you mentioned this a little bit earlier about some of your main competition being the East Germans and the Soviets. With 1968 being kind of the height of the Cold War and Vietnam, what effect, if any, did this political climate have on the games and relationships between athletes? And why, for example, did you see the East Germans and Soviets as your primary competition?
Well, first of all, the Germans had two teams, so they had six athletes.
Mm-hmm.
And probably four out of those six athletes were world class. And two of the guys had been medalists in 64. Rain Aaron from the USSR, but from he's really Estonian. He's not Russian. When I used to work on TV, if I called a Latvian or Russian, I'd get a letter 2 pages long explaining to me that they are not Russians. They are Latvians. So
I
became very conscious of that.
Absolutely.
But one of the Russians came up and gave me his pin, which I kept on during the gold medal ceremony. And he said, "I hope you win. You're the best." And then the East German asked for my autograph.
Oh.
So we weren't political combatants.
Mm-hmm.
Had nothing to do with us. I mean, these are decisions made by political people who never had to fight.
Mm-hmm.
What a waste of humanity.
So for you, the competition was purely sport related, it sounds like.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. We just had a reunion over in Germany, and I went twice. And you couldn't believe the camaraderie. The guys looked pretty much the same, except the Russian who broke my world record. He had a rather large stomach, but wonderful guy, Nikolai Avalov. And he was 19 in 68, but he got fourth. And Rain Aaron dropped out, but he still got a silver medal in 64. And then Walder got the silver, and the world record holder, Benlin, got the bronze. And I was glad because they were both really good guys. And I was in Germany. I trained with them. I mean, we all drank Dunkel beer after our workouts. We'd go to Dortmund by train, and Dunkel beer was non-alcoholic malt beer, and it was delicious. And that's all we could talk about during the workout is when we could get over to that bar and get some Dunkel beer. No, I mean, I became kind of international. You know, I lived in Germany for 6 months. Trained with a German coach, and after the Olympics, the German newspapers actually cited me as a German. German trained. It was pretty accurate because I learned things that I never would have had a chance to know about. But once again, different cultures have different approaches. Some things you take and some things you eliminate. I learned lots of little tricks to put in my bag.
What are some examples that you could give?
Oh, how to train for the hurdles more effectively. How to pole vault, how to high jump. So that I went from I made these events stronger events, hundreds of points.
Mm-hmm.
How to train for all the events and not just concentrate on running. And to be and train with your competition,
mm-hmm.
and know them as people and not as names.
Sure.
And I even played basketball over there.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I've lived alone. I had a really nice apartment. It was 4 marks to a dollar. It was like living in it where everything was 50% less. Now it's 1 mark to a dollar. My apartment was one of the swankiest places in town for $100 a month.
Sounds like it was a nice place to train.
Yeah, I belonged to a club, ASD, and I had a lot of friends there. And they put up with my broken German. And I really had a lot of adventures, you know. I took advantage. Every time I took a trip with the U.S., I would venture out into the town and get to know. You know, a lot of guys stayed in and played cards. I went out and got to meet people and buy things. And I mean, that was, you know, it was a cultural exchange for me.
Definitely.
And that the whole purpose of travel is to enlarge your horizons, you know, and to see things. I taught school in Germany. I was an English lehrer in Schiller Gymnasium, which was a gymnasium is a very highly rated secondary education, and I taught English. And I went over to the Culture Ministerium to get the job, and it was very tough for Americans because they wanted an English accent. So I faked an English accent and got the deal.
That's hilarious. So is that teaching job how you were able to support yourself while in Germany?
Well, I had a little bit of money that my uncle left me. He gave most of it to the church, but he left $50,000 to each of my brothers and I. And in those days, that was like $500,000.
Definitely.
I put that in the bank, and then when I needed it, I would call on it. So I was pretty much independent. And I would say it was one of the best investments I ever made.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, so it sounds like because of that, you were able to really kind of maintain the amateur ideal, or maybe it made it easier to stick to the rules of amateurism. And what do you think about that, about amateurism then versus now, and what money and commercialism have done to sports, how they've changed sports?
You know, it's very hard to say, but, you know, because there really it was sham amateurism, because there was still professional things going on. Guys were getting paid under the table, and it created a criminal aspect, you know. I mean, you're breaking the rules. I couldn't break the rules because I was taught at school to follow the rules. And if I was offered money, but if I took it, I would be guilty.
Mm-hmm.
I would have an approach that would have been less than perfect. And I didn't want to endanger my amateur standing. And so I never looked at it as something that I lost. I mean, surely in this environment, I would have been a very wealthy guy from track. I mean, because I was consistent, I was a good investment, and the shoe companies knew me because I had been, you know, I could speak German a little bit, and Adidas never, you know, I just needed shoes. I invented some of my own shoes, which they made for me, you know. So I wasn't looking to make money. I mean, once again, as you said, I wasn't married and having bills, and, you know, in that case, I might have been propelled towards that way, but I was a single guy who trained with a bunch of guys, and we all lived in Santa Barbara in Isla Vista over the ocean with an ocean view. Couldn't have had a better place to be. A bunch of guys from different countries came, and we had this huge fraternity of guys competing in the decathlon at the University of California, Santa Barbara. It was great years.
Yeah, it sounds like it. Well, going back to 68 and what an unusual year it was for the Olympics, gender verification testing was introduced and implemented in the 68 games. Do you remember this, and do you have any thoughts on that?
What did you say, drug testing?
Gender verification testing.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, yeah, there were some guys on the Russian team that didn't show up. The police called them the Press Brothers, Irina, and yeah. I was married, the mother of my children, Mary Rand. She was a gold, silver, and bronze medalist in Tokyo. And she welcomed it because she was competing against guys in girls' uniforms. I mean, it's a shame, but, you know, there was a gal named, it just goes back historically to, like, even Berlin, and this Polish Hella, oh, God, what was her name? Stella Walsh. She was shot by some kind of thief at a holdup at a liquor store. And, you know, when they autopsied her, they found out she was a man.
Hmm.
She won the 100.
So, were you aware of the disqualification for use of alcohol that occurred with a Swedish pentathlete during the 68 games?
Yeah, for the shooting.
Yes.
Yeah, there was a lot of Benzedrine in the 60s, and that's what they were testing for, that and downers, where shooting required, your heartbeat to slow down so
Right.
you'd have better control, because obviously nervousness and competition is a factor. But all that stuff, there's just scattered stories here and there and kind of overblown, and most of the athletes, canoe, kayak, all these different sports, they had no clue about drugs or even, I mean, I was glad I was dope tested, because I ran so fast the first day that they had to test me. But I was, they supposedly drew your number, and mine came up twice, which is statistically abnormal. But I was glad that I was dope tested, because, all kinds of accusations could have been made, because I broke all kinds of records, and because it was the Olympics. It was something in my mind had created. I was an Olympic monster. I created an environment that would be bulletproof in rain, hail, heat, or storm. When whatever was going on, it was not going to affect me.
Takes a lot of willpower, definitely psychological determination there.
Well, all the guys, I mean, the fastest 400 ever run, the fastest 200, the fastest 100, all of the times, 800 down, records were broken. And then, of course, the Kenyans came in, the steeplechase, and George Young got third, I think, which was great. But Jim Ryan got second, but it was a distant second to Bodo Tümler. As I said, anything over 800 meters, like 1500, 3000 steeplechase, 5000, 10000, Ron Clark fell by the wayside. Naftali Kanu won that. Kip Keno won the 1500. The marathon was won by an Ethiopian, Mama Walda. The Africans came from, Addis Ababa was like 8000, 9000 feet in some places. I've been there twice.
So that definitely had some advantage for them, for sure.
It does. It physiologically gives them a huge advantage, because their hemoglobin is off the charts.
Right.
It takes a lifetime of adaptation to altitude.
Yes, absolutely.
10 weeks is not gonna 10 weeks is not gonna do it for training camp at Echo Summit was at 7,300 feet. It was smart because the trials were held at the same altitude. I think because it was at a peak instead of a plateau, Mexico City is a plateau. I think there was even less oxygen in a mountain peak because of the amazing amount of plants and things like that, which, continually turn over oxygen into whatever. I can't remember my chemistry, but I think, there was plentiful oxygen at that 7,300 feet. I felt more so than there was at Echo Summit, which was top of a, top of a big hill going into Tahoe on Highway 50.
Right.
The only guys you had to worry were the distance guys, and in those races, and then one poor guy. The 400 almost died, and he turned gray, and it had something to do with sickle cell.
Oh, gosh.
He would have never made it, at Mexico City.
Yeah.
So it actually was a good idea to have. It wasn't a good idea to have it in Mexico, but I wasn't upset.
Sounds like you had an advantage there. Bill, were you there when Tommy Smith and John Carlos did their protest on the medal stand? Did you happen to witness
No,
it?
I had another couple of days before I competed.
Okay. Did
So I wasn't at the stadium.
you hear about it or notice?
Yeah, I to tell you the truth, I thought it was kind of a mild protest that people had made too much of a big deal out of. I knew one day it would turn in their favor, but it took a long time, and they were victims for quite a while. But now they're heroes. They're cultural heroes. I mean, they're looked upon by many blacks as being foremost in the movement of equality.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't think it was a bad thing at all. I thought it was quiet. I thought it was safe. But it hurt a lot of prickly reporters. How could they possibly do that during our national anthem? Well, how could we possibly do all the things that we did to them? They were second-rate citizens. You know, they had to grow up in agricultural areas and work the land and lived in, you know, pretty bad circumstances. And yet they represented the country. I think it was their right to say, you know, give us a better life.
So you think the USOC's and IOC's responses were harsh?
Ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
Ridiculous. Not philosophically akin to the level of what it should have been. It should have been dispensed with quickly. They could have had an attitude about it and let it go and not kick people out of the village and made martyrs of them. And they were stupid.
Mm-hmm. Well, some people say that the Olympics are an inappropriate place for this type of personal political expression. Well, what is your opinion about that?
Well, I mean, I can understand how a lot of people felt that way, but that was a long time ago. I think now people look at it differently.
Mm-hmm.
I think people look at it and say, you know, those poor guys had a right in their moment, their one moment in the spotlight, to say, America, wake up. Treat us equally. That was the message.
Sure.
And then black became beautiful.
Well, you talked a little bit about the media earlier and Howard Cosell and the interviews that you did after you won your gold medal. What were some of your other experiences with the media during the 68 games? Photographers, TV cameras, and did anyone back home see you on TV and tell you about it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I was viewed by America. I mean, I had the most exposure anybody could have. I didn't realize it. And then I went to the tower where ABC had their production center, and they showed me they showed me in every event in the trials to introduce each day. I mean, I was like an ongoing special. I mean, in the 100, some guy got 10 seconds. You know, I had 2 days, and then they used the end when I picked a German off the ground, who was one of my buddies, when he had, you know, just was out of it, and I helped him up, and, you know, we were just hugging there at the finish, happy to be medalists and friends again, and they showed that every night at the start of the games, you know, what was left, you know, swimming was left and some other things. So I was on constantly. I became a household name, and still today, certain people know my name, have a recognition of my name.
Well, absolutely. You were a national hero.
Well, especially since it happened right after the Black Power thing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, in a way, that kind of set me up. Selfishly, I mean, not that I'm one of those guys that, you know, I had no idea what was going to happen, neither did they. And I mean, I know more about it than I would say, but I don't think it's my right to. I think that's something they need to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
But they absolutely, I mean, the timing was like somebody had written it.
Hmm. Well, for you personally, what was the most memorable part of competing in the 68 games and of being part of that team?
The fact that we had a team that trained together, made the team together, and we all lived in trailers. we had a reunion, and we had very strong relationships. There was nobody who was out for themselves. We were all together. And that, I think, what made it to be one of the most unusual track teams. And we won together and stood together and represented the country in the best way that we could. There were a few people that got sick that would have won a medal. But these were the problems with Mexico City, and it was like roulette. You know, some guys, they spun the wheel, and they got the black or the red or the green. And maybe they got a green, which was sickness. Who knows? But there was a strong camaradeship.
Mm-hmm.
Comradeship. And when we had a reunion, like, I don't know, 8 years later, I mean, 8 years from now, it was incredible. It was like we hadn't, you know, I even overheard a lot of the guys going, they think it's too bad that track has become so financially oriented, and it's just a sport that they did for love. And these are black and white guys.
Mm-hmm.
But I was on the Pan Am team and the Olympic team, and I even got to run the relay against England and Italy, and, you know, because some guys didn't want to run, I was available. And it was my dream to be a member of a U.S. relay team. So, you know, I got to know all the guys. You know, I was part of a lot of different things. And that's the great thing about being in the decathlon. I used to love to go to Europe and compete against guys in the 200, in the 400, in the long jump, the high jump. You know, I could pick an event, the hurdles. One night in Stockholm, I won the hurdles and the 200 and beat Jim Hines in the 200. He was the world record holder.
Well, I'm sure you've been asked this many times, but what did it feel like to win that gold medal in 68?
You don't plan for it. You're kind of embarrassed a little bit. But when they play the national anthem, what's going through your head is all the people that helped you. And thinking maybe they're watching. And maybe all your school pals and close friends from your history at all different levels are sharing this. And what a great way to say, hey, how you doing? I'm doing fine. And it was very, very emotional. I didn't show it a whole lot, but my mind was racing with those kinds of thoughts. And of course, I was just thankful that it was over, and I decided that I was going to go another year, and I turned down all kinds of financial deals, and because I wanted to compete for a year as an Olympic champion.
Mm-hmm.
And there's nothing like standing at the end of the runway, and the announcer goes, and now in the long jump, Olympic champion Bill Toomey, and you go, holy geez. That's me. Bumped for a long time. That was a track bump. And then I was in England. It was in the John, and the door was closed, and these two English guys came in. You know, what kind of these old birds like Timmy just sort of retire and leave it to us? I mean, he just doesn't quit. I loved it.
Yeah. You know,
I mean, my last year I did 10 decathlon.
Amazing. Well, what did you do right after you won the gold medal? Did you celebrate with friends and family? Did you relax?
Well, yeah, I went out with two English people and Mary Rand, who was my girlfriend at the time. And some guy came up to me in the street. He said, "Were you at the stadium today?" And I said, "Yeah." He said, "How did Toomey do?" I said, "He won." The guy said, "Bless, you know," or "great," and walked away. And thought, wow, that's amazing.
So what are your memories and experiences of the closing ceremony?
I didn't make it. I was in bed. I was sick.
Oh, that's right.
But I've never been to a closing ceremony. Well, maybe someday, but not as an athlete.
Right. Well, what did you do right after the games? Did you go home and start training again? Did you travel some more?
Actually, I started training while I was in Mexico City.
Oh, my goodness.
After my sickness was over, I went out and started working out again. And because I knew there were meets, and you know, I was trying to figure out a way to quit, but I just couldn't do it. I had visited with these big time agents, and they told me this is a short window. You better take advantage. Give us all the names of people that showed interest, and we'll follow up. I said no. I said I'm going to compete for another year. They said, well, you're stupid. I said, yeah, I sure am. I'm doing something that I enjoy more than anything in life. And I had a great last year. And so I did 10 decathlons, and my last one, I broke the world record.
Wow. Astounding. That's wonderful.
It's kind of a nice way to go out.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, when you did finally finish that last year and you quit competing, what was that change like for you? How did you feel about it?
I kept working out. And I started a company to take advantage of things that were still coming in. And, I found myself helping the people that were hiring me. And I decided, you know, I actually had a pretty good instinct for marketing. So I started getting clients, and it was great. I found a new field of endeavor.
Mm-hmm.
Ended up doing work around the world in different countries. I worked for the Peace Corps actually for 4 years as a special advisor to the president, and I traveled to South America, Asia, and Africa. And a lot of guys, you know, were saying, you know, this is when I sort of missed the boat on the financial stuff. But, you know, what an experience I had. I mean, I had a passport that was, like an ambassador-type passport. Everywhere I went, you know, I had bodyguard in South in Venezuela. I've been to, I don't know how many countries. If I said 60, I would be underestimating the number of countries. And, you know, talk about going how many times to England, France, Sweden, you know, multiple times. I had more mileage than you can imagine. They didn't have those mileage programs then.
Mm-hmm.
But when I worked for the Peace Corps, I thought that was that gave me, when I did interviews, I had something to say.
Right.
Except, you know, my Olympic experience. But I took the Olympic experience and made it into a continued Olympic-oriented experience by helping other countries, by helping youngsters, by talking to coaches, by helping kids get into colleges in the U.S. Like, I met Christos Papanikolaou in Athens when I was on a State Department tour. And this is 1963. This is well before. This is my first international trip. He turned out to be the first man in the pole vault over 19 feet. And I got him a scholarship to San Jose State.
Hmm.
And I got guys. George Daniels went to Colorado. He's a 9200. And they were short one guy, and they're 4x100 relay, and they had the best team in the world when he showed up.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that was kind of fun to do.
Absolutely. Well, it sounds like the impact of your Olympic experience on your life was overwhelmingly positive. Were there any negatives?
No.
Mm-hmm.
If you're negative and you're in that zone, you need to just shrink. I don't care how bad the conditions are where you are. If you're connecting with people and you're helping and they appreciate it and it's a cultural interchange at any level, it's valuable.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like I'm beyond my education. I'm a very well-educated person in terms of the world, in terms of being able to deal and meet people. I met the Shah of Iran, went to his birthday party. I met all kinds of political types, film types. I was on the Carson show twice, and he actually called me, and we became friends. I was on all kinds of TV shows. And then I ultimately did TV for CBS for 5 years.
Mm-hmm. You have a wonderful announcer's voice.
Oh, thank you. That's very nice of you to say.
Well,
it's not cultivated. That's my real voice.
What one piece of advice would you give to today's Olympic hopeful?
To avoid negativity, to investigate every aspect of your preparation, from nutrition to the psychological aspects, and to determine whether or not you're harming yourself by allowing yourself to be a victim of other people's views or thoughts, and to not set a specific goal, because by putting a cap on it, you dissolve the ability to go beyond that. So I wanted to do the best that I could do, and I never said it's going to be this height, that speed. And so in the Olympic trials, I was on fire. I mean, I jumped almost 6'7" with a straddle, which would have converted to about 7 feet with the Fosbury. Because all the other guys that were jumping 5'10", and I was jumping 6'7", they went to 2 meters, which was 6'6". I mean, there's no doubt that it's faster takeoff. You use the front part of your leg muscle instead of the back, the quadricep instead of the biceps femoris, and you can go faster and you can go higher. And your center of gravity travels underneath the bar rather than over. Stuff like that. But I would have fun. If it's not fun, don't do it.
Mm-hmm. Sounds like great advice.
Once I had fun, I got better and better and better.
Mm-hmm.
And don't complain. Think in terms of progress and competitiveness. And when you enter a race, if you think you're going to be second, you will be. So when I ran against Jim Hines in Stockholm, I said, I'm going to take him. And so I ran the first 100 meters around the turn as fast as I could, and I was right on his shoulder, and then I just kicked by him right at the finish. Mm. He was very upset. But that stadium, which was full, couldn't believe it. And that a decathlete, I had been a world record holder, but, I wasn't the fastest guy in the world. Mm. But that night I was.
Yeah, for sure.
And that's hot stuff,
Yeah.
I had a lot of fun. I really had a lot of fun.
That's the important thing. Well, Bill, I wanted to ask you a couple of questions about things that I read, maybe from other interviews that you did in the past. But I read something about a hand injury or a problem with one of your hands.
Yeah, unfortunately, when I was 12 years old, a kid threw a dish under a door and it broke and ripped my wrist open and it cut my median nerve in half, and that paralyzed about 75-80% of my hand. Now, I've read lately, because I did some research, that if they get to it within the first 3 weeks, they can regain the majority, and they now have the technique. They didn't know that I could move my fingers, so they thought I was all right, so they sewed up the injury. But the nerve was split in half, and so the majority of my hand had no feeling. And until one night I was playing with a wood-burning kit, and my fingers were on the burning tip, which is so hot you can't believe it. I mean, and my fingers started to burn in smoky flesh, and I had these huge blisters for months afterwards until it healed. But they then decided that maybe Bill, because I kept saying I can't feel anything. I was 12 years old, and I went out and tried to learn how to play basketball left-handed. Hmm. I'd go day after day, and nothing would happen. And then after one of my operations, my brother and I went to a track meet a week after an operation. I mean, operation is a pretty serious thing. They knock you out. They put you under. I ran a track meet and passed out after the 400, and they woke up in a tent, and this nurse said, "What's wrong?" My brother said, "Well, he just had an operation. I had my wrist wrapped up, so, I jumped, and I ran the 400, and I still have these two little trophies as a memory of how much I enjoyed competition, even at that age. But you don't have an operation and then go run a track meet a week later. But I can't feel like the shot put and the discus and the javelin and the pole vault. It's very difficult. I'd always have to check with my hands visually to see if I was holding it right in the pole vault. And the discus, I finally got over 150 feet and close to 160, but my first decathlon line was like 70 feet. A shot was something like 31 feet, and I finally got almost 48 feet at 16 pounds. But I just had no muscles in my thumb and most of my fingers. So it was all adapted to, kind of like throwing with the heel of my hand. And it's what kept me out of the Olympics the first time. But I then was able to throw the javelin under 230 feet. And that came in handy sometimes.
But absolutely.
I also would slip sometimes when it was wet, And so I had to learn how to deal with having a paralyzed right hand. I mean, I would have qualified for the Olympics for the disabled.
Hmm. That's astounding that you were able to do so well.
I can't button my shirt. When I change the radio in my car, I use my pinky because that's the only one that has feeling. I had 5 surgeries, and all I got back was a sense of a change of temperature. I didn't know whether it was hot or cold. But at least that kept me away from dangerous areas like the end of a wood-burning kit.
Right.
I don't know how many degrees Fahrenheit, but it's really hot. Red tip.
Yeah.
And I didn't feel it.
That's.
And then it was years before they got to it. I mean, I had my last operation when I was a senior in high school.
Oh, wow.
And then one doctor, the first doctor, screwed it up worse. He cut out part of my median nerve. So I had to have a nerve joining and stretching. I couldn't get my hand. It was parallel to my arm. I couldn't get it to go back like you do a push-up. I used to have to do push-ups on my fist.
Mm. Right, you couldn't bend your wrist.
But, I never told anybody.
And why was that?
I would have an excuse.
Uh-huh.
That's how I got into track, though, because I could jump. I didn't need my hand.
Mm-hmm.
But then I was in a small school and they had javelin in Connecticut, and I thought, what the heck? I'll try that. And I wasn't too bad. I mean, even though I couldn't feel it, I was an old baseball pitcher, and I had a good arm, and I just learned how to use sticky stuff to, to get a good grip on it. And then, but the discus and shot, that was a lot of work. And I realized that I was never going to get a lot of points. So I didn't spend a lot. I studied the tables and I realized where I could improve. And I knew that running and jumping were my forte because it didn't require my hand. But then I got to over 14 feet without bending the pole, which is a very good vault for non-bending. You know, if I would have learned how to vault properly, I could have been better, but could have, would have, should have. And the shot, the fact that I only choose like 45 feet in the Olympics and the discus 140 something, but in the world record, I do 40, close to 48 and well over 100, like 158 or, I don't know, in the high 50s, 150s. And that's a pretty good throw for anybody.
Absolutely.
So, you know, I was proud of myself.
And you should be for overcoming such an injury and all those surgeries. Well, Bill, I wanted to ask you about something else I read, and I'm not sure if you said this or not, but the Olympic movement is divided into two very distinct eras. Did you say that at one point? And if so, what did you mean by that?
Well, you know, the amateur and then the professional.
Okay. So what we talked about earlier.
Yeah, and money is, you know, some guys run hurt because there's money involved, and that way it becomes very damaging, you know?
Right.
But then again, there's a lot of people who come from very poor backgrounds, and this enables them to have a decent life, and you can't, you know, there's ways to get around it. You know, they could be used in marketing if they have a good sense of marketing, and that becomes a real job. But most of them just compete, wear the shoes of the company, and they don't really have to perform anything. I always did marketing. When I was hired by Bristol-Myers and lost my amateur standing, I actually was going into stores and making calls with sales guys and developing marketing programs. And really, that was my profession.
Mm-hmm.
And doing interviews. So, I mean, there was a case where I probably should have been, but would I have gone to the 72 games? I have no idea. You know, because it was over. But I qualified. I did a decathlon in 72 in Santa Maria and met the qualifying standard. But, I would have needed to start, like, in 1970. I probably could have made the team. And I might have been able to get a medal, and it would have been fun. And, you know, once you win a gold medal, you don't have to worry about what you do. You have nothing to lose, because you always have a world record, a gold medal, and individual events. They still haven't run as fast as I did in the 400, and they only recently tied my 100, but I did 26 feet in the long jump, which I never in college would have imagined I could have done. That's a hell of a long jump for, you know, a non-long jumper.
Quite.
And I was measured at 27 feet, but I was behind the board.
Hmm.
And this coach, Telez at UCLA, said, "Do you realize how far you jumped?" I said, "No." I think it was 25.6. He said, "No, but where you took off from was the whole board and then about another 8 inches. I said, "Thanks for ruining my day." So, I mean, I had the leg strength. This was all basketball stuff. It's amazing, you know. I stuck with it till I was 29 in the Olympics and 30. I was almost 31 when I broke the world record. So it took me a long time because I didn't start till 1963.
Mm-hmm.
So think about it, 63, 64, 65, 66, 6 years to win a gold medal.
Yeah. Well, did people think that your age was unusual at that time? Were there other athletes?
Yeah, I was the oldest guy to win at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And now they stand longer because of the money. And Dan O'Brien was slightly older than me. But he missed the team in 92 because he missed the opening height in the pole vault. It almost happened to me several times.
Well, why do you think you were able to compete for so long, or well, not so long, but into that age? Why?
Well, I worked out well. I got smart. I ate well. I was into nutrition, and I had a good time. I was a teacher. I had a job. Most of these guys don't have jobs. And one other thing I try to tell them is balance your day. Have something. Don't be thinking about the competition for 24 hours a day. Get a job. Get something else. Take your mind off. Mm-hmm. You could drive yourself crazy thinking about it.
Sure, sure.
But if you have a job, then you have a balanced life.
Right.
It's a healthier way to exist. And when track's over and the paydays stop, you got a job.
Right. Something to fall back on, for sure. Well, before we close the interview, is there anything else that you would like to say or tell us about before we close?
Well, I think you've covered quite a bit, and I probably could go on for another couple hours because I haven't really gotten into a lot of things, but I think you have adequate amount of information and that might benefit somebody who would tune in and listen.
Definitely.
And so I think... yeah, it's fine.
Well,
I enjoyed it. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much.